I'm Victor Sweezy, host of The Land in Between from the Global Reporting Center. Join us on a trip to the Republic of Georgia, a country at the crossroads of the EU and Putin's Russia. From the tear gas-filled streets of the capital to the manicured gardens of a billionaire oligarch, I'll take you to a critical moment in Georgia's history and explore what it means for the future of our world order. Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
These strikes on Iran have taken out the country's leader. The U.S. president has been calling on Iranians to rise up and show that they are in charge.
The idea that everyone is going to the streets to uproot the system or the establishment in Iran is more of wishful thinking.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, how secession works in the Islamic Republic and how the current war might or might not upend it. Plus, the current status of Iran's nuclear capabilities.
You can't bomb a program like this away.
Also, we return to the scene of a poisoning in a Russian hotel.
I'm sitting here, waiting for the tea to steep. All that becomes much more of a reality.
And repurposing old movie music for a current hit from Brazil, today, here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us today. U.S. citizens in more than a dozen countries in the Middle East have been urged to leave as President Trump says the worst is ahead for Iran.
Explosions shook across Tehran for a fourth night. And fighting continues to escalate across the region. Israeli attacks on Lebanon and Hezbollah targets there have killed more than 50 people and displaced more than 50,000. That's according to the Lebanese government. A reporter in Beirut for Al Jazeera went to a suburb that was hit by those strikes and got as close as she could to the scene while firefighters put out the flames.
Thick smoke in the distance. I saw three buildings leveled to the ground, and these strikes keep coming in.
She says it began on Monday when Hezbollah launched missiles and drones at Israel.
And since then, the Israeli military has been doing what it promised to do, and that is to intensify strikes.
In Washington today, President Trump met in the Oval Office with German Chancellor Friedrich Merz. The two leaders spoke to reporters, with Trump responding to a question about whether Israel pressured him to join their attack on Iran.
Mr. President, did Israel force your hand to launch these strikes against Iran? Did Netanyahu pull the United States into this war?
No, I might have forced their hand.
Trump went on to say that America was ready and Israel was ready. As for Merz, he backed up his host to a point.
We are on the same page in terms of getting this terrible regime in Tehran away. And we will talk about the day after, what will happen then if they are out.
The day after. What will happen then? That is where we begin our coverage today. The assassination Sunday of Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei has left a gap at the top of Iran's power structure. Trump has repeatedly called on the Iranian people to rise up and topple their regime. Ali Hashem spoke with me today about how likely that might be and who might lead Iran next. Hashem is a war correspondent and a research affiliate at the Center for Islamic and West Asian Studies at the University of London. He joined us from Doha.
The idea that everyone is going to the streets to uproot the system or the establishment in Iran is more of wishful thinking. The only thing that might happen in Iran in such a situation where the state is disintegrated and in a situation of weakness is that there might be a civil war in Iran and the country might be divided into several states. So it's more of a balkanization of Iran, something like Yugoslavia in the 90s, rather than just a very huge revolution toppling an unpopular system. This ideological system has its very solid base, and it's made up of millions. And already it's armed. It has its IRGC, which is an ideological military that is made to defend the revolution or the republic.
The IRGC, the Powerful Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps.
Yes.
I want to get to that system and its stability in just a second. But if there were anti-regime protesters who did take to the streets in the near term, what would likely happen to them?
It's most probably we're going to see more blood. We're going to see more crackdown, especially if we're talking about people that are going to the street without anything. There is a guide for revolutions in this region. We've seen that in different states, and I've covered that from Syria to Libya to Egypt, everywhere. If the army is not changing sides, then nothing's gonna happen. Except if there is a strong militia coming from somewhere, armed to the teeth, then maybe something else will happen, but it will take also years of civil war till this is achieved.
You mentioned nothing happens unless the military changes sides, basically. President Trump had a message for Iran's armed forces over the weekend.
I once again urge the Revolutionary Guard, the Iranian military, police, to lay down your arms and receive full immunity or face certain death.
Are we seeing any signs of cracks within the Revolutionary Guard, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, so far?
I can't say. But what we are seeing when it comes to the daily attacks the IRGC is launching towards Israel, towards different areas in the region, towards American targets, gives an indication that they are still solid. They are still in a situation where there's no cracks that can be reported. At least this is the picture. But, you know, we're just dealing with the picture from outside. Mm-hmm. We don't know inside what's going on.
Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei led Iran for 35 years. He does not have an obvious public heir. How will the next leader be chosen?
There is a council leading the country, and this is what we are dealing with currently. However, the Assembly of Experts should be convening and electing a new leader. Now, we're hearing reports of an Israeli attack on the building that the experts were meeting in. The Assembly of Experts is made up of clerics, very senior clerics, around 88 clerics, who are supposed to choose the next leader, who also should be a cleric.
And that assembly has already been meeting, you're saying?
Well, according to Israeli reports, they've attacked the building where the assembly was meeting. Now, according to the Iranian sources, there was no one there. Now, in the situation of war, they might do the vote on the phone. They might do the vote in different ways. Most probably, the Iranian deep state would want to see someone who can preserve continuity, who could be very calm transition from Khamenei to the new situation, who believes in the core thoughts and ideas and doctrine of the revolution. There'll be a meeting. There'll be candidates. There'll be elections. The 88 members should vote. There should be a majority, 50% plus one of the council. Then they will go for a second round. And in the second round, whoever takes just a slight majority of the votes can win.
So Khamenei's appointment some 35 years ago was also during, you know, challenging times for the Iranian government. And it kind of proves the stability of this system.
Well, yes. I mean, Iran was freshly out of a long war with Iraq, the 8 years Gulf War, and of course, the death of Khomeini himself. You know, Khomeini was the founder of the Islamic Republic. And most reports and analysis during the 80s were referring to the possibility of the collapse of the Islamic Republic just after the death of Khomeini. Well, the fact that this system was built in a way that it doesn't really rely on one person on its head. What right now is happening is that the United States and Israel are trying to disintegrate the system from within, attacking the experts council, the Assembly of Experts during the meeting, or even if not during the meeting. This just reflects attempts to deny the establishment in Iran its basic routes to the leadership. How much will this be successful? Days will say.
I'm speaking with Ali Hashem, a research affiliate at the Center for Islamic and West Asian Studies at the University of London. That's interesting. So you've argued that Iran was built, its systems were built to withstand its leadership being decapitated, basically, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC, also this assembly of experts. They're all built to come together in times of trouble. And you're saying that the U.S. and Israel are going after those strong institutions to try to bring down the leadership.
Yes. So now what we are witnessing is that there's an attempt on the same institutions by trying to collapse them from in within by killing them. And this is, I've never seen this. I've never heard this. I've never read this before.
Ali, you said you've never seen that before. Does history tell us anything about whether that might be an effective strategy that the U.S. and Israel are employing?
Well, you know, one of the issues and pillars of this system in Iran is resistance. And this is what Khamenei, the late leader, has been preaching for the last decades of his rule. So this system is made to absorb hits. Now, how much will this system absorb hits? How much solutions from in within it can create? I mean, this will show how much really it can sustain. The more it can sustain, the more the war is going to be long. And it's clear the Iranians are trying to prolong the war and take it from a situation of a contained conflict, just like President Trump and Bibi Netanyahu are trying to do, into a situation where the whole region is paying the price for it. And that's why we are seeing the Gulf being hit. We're seeing a new front open in Lebanon and Hezbollah resurrecting once again. The closure of the, I mean, de facto closure of the Hormuz Strait, despite the fact there's no announcement. And probably the Houthis getting into this war and closing the Bab el-Mandab Strait and the Red Sea. So the Iranian strategy here is just turn the table, and rather than it being a limited crisis, turn it into a global conflict or a global crisis where everyone in the world will be paying the price and then everyone will rush to stop it.
It seems clear that Ayatollah Khamenei had planned for his own assassination. I read a report suggesting he had instructed everyone in leadership roles to name four layers of succession. Can you confirm that?
Well, this is what we heard also. This is what we read. It's very possible because he was a very cautious person.
Is there a public funeral planned for Khamenei?
Well, this is a big question. Till the moment, we don't have any reports. We don't have any news of this. Given the fact the country is in a situation of war, it's very unlikely that they will take such a risk. And if they take such a risk, it's going to be really dangerous. However, given the way the Iranians think, they would love to give as the establishment, they would love to give their leader, who is now to them a martyr, kind of a proper send-off. But, I mean, with this war going on, no one knows if there is going to be any possibility. Today, in Tehran itself, there are several attacks in different areas. So they are under a lot of pressure, under a lot of bombs from the sky, falling from the sky, not only in Tehran, but in several cities. So, yeah, I think it's a dilemma.
From the perspective of the Iranian public, which I understand is not a monolith, what do you see as the best and worst case scenarios for how all of this plays out?
Well, given, Karin, I've just been back from Iran. I was there just before the war. I stayed there for like around 3 weeks. And I did several interviews in the streets with people and analysts. And it's clear that despite the different positions, there are people who are against the war and want to fight. And there are people who are with the war. The main concern the Iranians have is that this country will disintegrate and will be divided into several other countries. Iranians survived through generational traumas. Their country ceased to exist for around 8 centuries, just after the Arab invasion of Persia during the first years of Islam. So everyone is thinking the Yugoslavian model could be applied to Iran, and then rather than having one unified country, they will have different states.
It is the dictionary definition of an existential crisis right now for Iranians.
Absolutely.
Ali Hashem is a war correspondent and research affiliate at the Center for Islamic and West Asian Studies at the University of London. He joined us from Doha.
Stay with us for more on the war in the Middle East later in the show. You're with The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Five European governments have shared results of their investigation into the 2024 death of Russian opposition activist Alexei Navalny. The researchers from the UK, France, Germany, Sweden, and the Netherlands concluded last month that the Russian government was responsible. That was not a big surprise, but the means used to kill him, that was new. A rare lethal toxin derived from a frog species in South America. From London, Russian reporter Ilya Kolmanovsky and Ilya Meretz have been digging deeper into the latest in a long, gruesome history of the Kremlin's use of chemicals to kill opposition figures. Ilya Meretz sets the stage.
The poison is a neurotoxin called epibatidine, but I'm no scientist, so when the news came, I got in touch with a friend who is a scientist and also is Russian. And you told me something, Ilya. You were actually kind of annoyed that all these headlines were being written about how Navalny was killed with toxins from South American dart frogs.
Yeah, because immediately the public would probably get that image of Kremlin agents delivering buckets of slimy amphibians from the Ecuadorian jungle to Siberia. And this is very, very wrong. It's not the way this kind of science works, and this is not how Russian assassination programs work.
Right. They work with chemicals developed in labs. Russian scientists have been making synthetic epibatidine for over a decade.
So let's go back to how such things start. The substance was first discovered in the 1970s by a scientist working for the US government named John Daly. And he was looking for new medicines. So he collected samples from dozens of different frogs in Ecuador. And one of those samples caused convulsions in mice. Soon it was clear that it also has the potential as a painkiller. They called this new substance epibatidine, and later it was shown to be 200 times more powerful than morphine. But because it was so toxic, no one could figure out how to put it to use.
No one, except for some scientists in Russia. We know this because they actually published papers on their work in 2013 about how they made epibatidine in labs.
And these were not just any Russians. These particular Russians worked at the infamous Institute of Organic Chemistry and Technology.
This institute is a confusing, troubling place. The research done there can improve lives, it can save lives, or it can end them.
Because it's the same place that developed Novichok, a nerve agent that has been used in a number of killings. In fact, in 2020, 4 years before he was killed with epibatidine, Alexei Navalny was poisoned with that substance, Novichok.
Before that, in 2018, there was the attempted killing of a former Russian agent in Salisbury here in England, which resulted in the killing of a woman named Dawn Sturgis, who was not the target. Again, Novichok. But it was another killing, almost 20 years ago, that woke the world up to Russia's chemical warfare program. Alexander Litvinenko, a UK citizen and former Russian spy, met two other Russians in a hotel bar. Shortly afterwards, he became violently ill and was admitted to hospital. He died there a few weeks later. It happened here in London, in Mayfair. So, Ilya and I went to have a look around.
Maybe one pot for two.
A pot for two?
It's the kind of place you'd go to have a quiet conversation.
And I was wondering, how am I going to feel when we come here? Isn't it a strange thing to do? But for me, now sitting here, waiting for the tea to steep, well, that becomes much more of a reality, that horrible, horrible reality and the atrocity and savagery of what happened here.
It wasn't until a full decade later that British authorities established definitively that Litvinenko had been poisoned with the radioactive isotope polonium-210, which he invested from a pot of green tea served in the hotel.
By then, everyone knew Russia was behind the killing, and doctors had long suspected a radioactive substance was the cause. So why is it important for governments to take tissue samples, do the analysis, and draw conclusions? I decided to talk about this with the doctor who treated Alexei Navalny the first time he was poisoned with Novichok in 2020. The doctor's name is Alexander Polupan.
Меня зовут Александр Полупан, я врач-анестезиолог, реаниматолог.
Back in 2020, Dr. Polupan fought to be allowed to treat Alexei Navalny at Russian hospital, and then he fought the authorities to allow Navalny to be taken to Germany for further medical treatment.
Мы приехали в больницу около 5 часов утра. Нам вкратце рассказали.
Remembering back to that time, Polupan found it strange that he wasn't allowed to wear his own regular scrubs while caring for Navalny. Anyone who touched him was asked to wear a disposable uniform and gloves. It's a possible sign the intelligence services knew a toxin was present and it was highly dangerous for bystanders.
German medical examiners quickly determined the poison was Novichok, and Navalny made a recovery in Germany, only to be poisoned and killed a few years later in Russia with epibatidine, as five European governments have now concluded. In response, the Russian authorities mocked that finding. On its Facebook page, Russia's UK embassy called it a political pageant and necropropaganda.
Epibatidine, whatever the poison, accountability for Russia's killings feels a very long way off. So I asked Dr. Polupan why it matters to do these investigations. He said, only by doing this work can the chain of perpetrators be revealed, and one day, maybe, there will be some kind of justice. For the world, I'm Ilya Kolmanovsky.
And I'm Ilya Meretz, London.
Ilya Kolmanovsky's science podcast is The Naked Mole Rat. China boasts not just the fastest single train in the world, but also one of the most advanced train systems on the planet. Now the city of Hefei is pushing the envelope even further. They're deploying a team of autonomous robots known as a robot cluster in public transit.
The robots are supposed to help with routine tasks to boost the efficiency of human workers. Dai Rong is with the Hefei Transit Authority. He explained on Chinese state TV that the robots do three main things. They provide service in stations, and they inspect trains and tunnels.
So, what does that look like? Well, humanoid robots with large touch screens on their torsos can give people directions in waiting areas and on platforms. Robot dogs and drones patrol the station for safety and surveillance, and maintenance robots get down under the trains with cameras and sensors, speeding up routine checks.
Luo Lei is also with the Hefei Metro. He says the robot cluster is just getting started. In the future, he says, we aim to build this platform using large AI model technology. He also mentioned plans for a better central brain to command the drones and robot dogs.
No poop to pick up with robot dogs. That's pretty convenient.
Less cuddly, though. Just how close was Iran to having nuclear weapons? That is coming up. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Since the start of the current war in the Middle East, some of the Trump administration's justifications for the conflict have shifted. But one objective seems constant: preventing Tehran from developing a nuclear weapon. Last week, talks in Switzerland were still underway with all parties at the table as the U.S. and Israel tried to limit Iran's nuclear program. In an interview with NBC News on Saturday, Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, stated that Tehran was not pursuing an atomic bomb.
We have never wanted a nuclear weapon. There is both religious convictions by us, the verdict by the Supreme Leader, who consider all these weapons as inhumane. At the same time, they have no place in our security doctrine. But I would like to reaffirm once again that we have proved our goodwill.
Last June, the U.S. and Israel launched airstrikes targeting Iran's nuclear facilities. Trump's assessment after that strike, the country's nuclear program was, quote, obliterated. So let's get a clear picture of the reality of Iran's nuclear capabilities with Daria Dolzhikova. She's a nuclear proliferation expert at the Royal United Services Institute for Defense and Security Studies in the UK. When we spoke today, Dolzhikova told me that before last year's strikes, Iran had uranium that was 60% enriched.
So 60% enrichment is not quite where you'd need uranium to be for use in a nuclear weapon, but it's getting pretty close. And they had accumulated enough of that material for them and of material enriched other levels for them to be able to, I think the estimate was, produce about 5 nuclear weapons in under a week and more after that, obviously. Now, I will caveat that heavily by saying that enriching to 90% is not sufficient for a nuclear weapon. You can't just have the fissile material. You have to actually construct the nuclear warhead. You have to mount it on a delivery system. And by the sounds of it, the Iranians weren't quite there yet. And critically, the most critical aspect is not just the material bit of it, but the political decision to move towards weaponization. And again, by all accounts, that decision had not been made inside Iran. So the program was quite advanced in terms of where it was materially, wasn't quite at a nuclear weapon, and the political decision hadn't been made to move in that direction just yet, but it was still of significant concern.
You're saying, though, that if they had reached 90%, they could have built, or they said they could have built, 5 bombs in a week?
Well, so they would have had sufficient material for, I think at the time, if I'm remembering correctly, it was about 5 bombs in under a week. But again, just having that fissile material is not sufficient for a nuclear weapon. You'd need to actually weaponize, create the warhead mounted on a delivery system.
So what do we know with certainty about what happened to Iran's nuclear capabilities since the U.S. strikes on those research facilities last year?
So we don't have full clarity of the extent of the damage, but the general consensus had been that the program had been set back quite significantly. Now, having said that, there's a reason that the Iranian nuclear program was as spread out as it had been and as expansive as it had been.
When you say spread out, you mean geographically spread out?
Geographically, but also in terms of the extent of material that they were accumulating, the extent of facilities that they had. It's because the program was meant to be redundant, because there was the expectation that potentially it might face precisely what it has faced, which is military attack. So they wouldn't have had to reconstruct the whole program to still pose a proliferation threat. The expectation is that some Iranian centrifuges survived. So that's the technology that would be used to enrich this fissile material to a point where it's ready for weaponization. And also there was quite a significant concern over the fact that about 400 kilograms of 60% enriched uranium had not been located and that might have been survived. So you put those two things together, the centrifuges and the highly enriched uranium most likely having survived, that did pose a proliferation concern. That again, you put those two together and you could potentially enrich to a level where it would cause a proliferation issue. There was no indication that they were doing that, but there were serious concerns that they could potentially move in that direction.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, tried to get into some of those sites that had been attacked by the U.S. and Israel. But as recently as last November, Iranian officials had prevented them. Did the IAEA ever get a chance to see what happened before this weekend? Like, how would we know if Iran was restarting this research?
Yeah, so that was a big issue, that the IAEA did not have access to the attacked facilities. There really would have been no way outside of the collection of intelligence by, I'm assuming, the U.S. and Israel for us to have known if Iran had restarted enrichment.
I'm speaking with Daria Dolzhikova, a nuclear proliferation expert at the Royal United Services Institute. So last September, our colleagues at Frontline, WGBH, interviewed Iran's chief nuclear negotiator, Ali Larijani. Here's what he had to say about how much last year's strikes by the U.S. damaged Iran's nuclear program. He said, quote, "In my opinion, Iran's nuclear program can never be destroyed because once you've discovered a technology, they can't take the discovery away," end quote. I mean, he said they had the know-how and that can't be taken away. What do you make of that assessment, Daria?
I think that's exactly right. This is why experts, myself included, had warned that you can't bomb a program like this away. In the case of Iran, this is a program that's existed since the 1950s. So it's generations old. Iran has extensive expertise, extensive technology that it is able to rebuild. So you can bomb away facilities, but it's precisely right. You can't bomb away latent expertise.
I mean, there were talks in Geneva last week about this very issue concerning Iran's nuclear program. The knowledge is there. I'm wondering, what were the sticking points, and would that have been one of them?
Of course, we don't know the details of what was discussed, but there has been some reporting around what could have been put on the table. There's a significant gap, and it sounds like up until the end, there was quite a significant gap between what the Americans were expecting of the Iranians and what the Iranians had put on the table. So the Iranians had, again, I'm going off of what's been publicly reported, I've not confirmed it myself, but the Iranians had offered, by the sounds of it, to potentially pause enrichment for some time. That was something that the Americans for a long time were pushing, this idea of absolutely no enrichment. So it sounds like the Iranians had agreed to at least put a pause on enrichment, but then wanted to start enriching again in the future for, they said, the production of material for nuclear fuel for the future expansion of their civil nuclear program. But what they had put on the table was enrichment to much higher levels than they had been permitted to engage in under the previous Iran nuclear deal. And they had suggested that they would be enriching with much more advanced centrifuges, so much more efficient and quicker centrifuges than what had been allowed under the Iran nuclear deal. So that was, by the sounds of it, and by what we've seen, it was a non-starter for the Americans.
So another objective by the U.S. and Israel is to destroy Iran's missile development capabilities, not just a potential atomic device that could be placed on a long-range missile. Trump has implied that Iran's missile development is aimed at creating systems that could reach the U.S. mainland with nuclear warheads. Is there merit to that concern?
To a certain extent, yes. So Iran doesn't have intercontinental ballistic missiles, but it has been engaged in research and testing of space launch vehicles. And I'm by no stretch of the imagination a missile expert, but my understanding is that those space launch vehicles could be the expertise that Iran gains, the technology that Iran develops as a result of the testing of those space launch vehicles could be directly transferred to the development of intercontinental ballistic missiles as well. Now, the Iranians say that those tests were not for the development of ICBMs, but I can certainly see why the Americans and others were concerned.
Are we seeing right now that any personnel or facilities related to Iran's nuclear program are being targeted or struck in the current fighting?
So just earlier today, there have been reports that the Natanz facility, so that's one of the enrichment facilities in Iran, has been struck. And it looks like the entrances to the facility have been targeted. So there's a part of that facility is underground. So it looks like the entrances into the tunnels have been targeted. Now, that facility was targeted during the June strikes as well. So the expectation is that a lot of the inside of that facility will have already suffered damage. Again, it's underground, so it's a little bit hard to say. But again, it looks like it's been hit again. And the fact that they've hit the entrances suggests that perhaps there was concern that Iran is or might in the future be looking to rebuild that facility or access some of the material that's left or the technology that's left in there.
Daria, finally, in your opinion, was Iran's nuclear program posing an imminent threat last year before the strikes in June or more recently in the midst of last week's negotiations in Geneva?
It's very hard to say without having access to the information that the Americans and the Israelis will have been going off of. By the sounds of it, back in June, Israel had come across some kind of information that suggested that the Iranian nuclear program might have been advancing perhaps more quickly than they had expected. So that raised concerns for them. But again, without knowing what information the Israelis or the Americans had, what intelligence they had, it's a little bit hard for me to assess. But, you know, having said that, if the assessment of the U.S. intelligence community and the U.S. administration was correct, that they had significantly set back the program, if not obliterated it, then that raises questions for me around what will have happened in the last however many 6-7 months that made them completely change that assessment, that the program is not in fact severely damaged or obliterated, but that it posed an imminent nuclear threat.
Daria Dolzikova speaking with me there. She's an expert in nuclear proliferation with the Royal United Services Institute in the UK.
Israel stepped up airstrikes on Iranian missile launchers and factories today. Iran retaliated against Israel and across the Gulf region, further disrupting energy supplies and travel. The United States also bombed targets today, firing from the sea.
Iran then sent drones to attack the American embassies in Saudi Arabia and Dubai. In Iran, hundreds of people have been killed. President Trump said some among the dead had been seen as possible future leaders of the country. In Israel, about a dozen people have been killed.
Well, all of this is happening. Jews around the world marked the holiday of Purim last night. It celebrates a moment 2,500 years ago when a plot to exterminate the Jews of Persia was foiled. It is a joyous ritual with music and dancing and people in costumes. Celebrations were held in Israel this year, even in the midst of this new war, against the advice of Israeli authorities. The World's Aaron Schachter reports.
Unlike the usual boisterous street parades, these Tel Aviv celebrations were held underground, two stories below a mall. Reporter Stephanie Freed describes the scene.
This is an underground car park, and it's very dimly lit. It's dark. So you've got, like, spotlights that are lighting up the areas. But otherwise, it's dark, but that doesn't stop anyone from having a good time.
Hundreds of people of all ages were there, many dressed in costumes. Purim is kind of like Halloween in that way. There were lots of princesses and Cinderellas, Batmans, cowboys, and a 9-year-old dressed as a clown. He says, the party's good. After all the air raid sirens and going into the suffocating bomb shelter, this is good. The boy's sister is dressed in a cornflower blue fairy outfit. It is strange that we're in a parking garage, she says, but this is fun, really fun. There were jugglers, face painters, balloon animals, and lots of wine, for the adults, that is. Rayut, who didn't want to give her last name, says her kids weren't sure about coming at first. But with Purim basically shut down during the war in Gaza, she and her husband thought it would be good for them to come this year.
We're in a horrible situation for 2.5 years, and you can put it on the kids. They want to have their Purim and have their fun and have their celebrations, and that's the reason.
Rayut's husband says it's especially fraught for the family now. He's a reservist headed back to the army next week. In one corner of the parking garage, a makeshift synagogue is set up. A gray-bearded man reads the Book of Esther from the Bible, which tells the story of Purim. Whenever the name Haman is read, the tradition is to boo. Haman, the top advisor to the Persian king, is considered the villain of the story. He's the one who wanted to kill all the Jews in Persia in what is modern-day Iran. The plan is ultimately foiled by Queen Esther, who, unbeknownst to the king, is Jewish. Mario Margulis is a Tel Aviv resident who set up a tent in the parking garage. She and her husband and their 6-month-old son have sheltered there for the past few days. They're afraid of Iranian bombs following Israeli and American strikes on Iran.
It's definitely biblical in proportions, what's happening right now. And doing the little bit that we can, just staying calm, staying joyful. Like the holiday is all about choosing happiness, choosing to be joyful, no matter what else is going on.
It's like the same plot of Purim with a different cast, her husband Daniel Margulis says. A man who would give his name only as Yotam was dressed as Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, with a black turban, white robe, and sunglasses. Khamenei was killed by airstrikes on Saturday.
Every year we celebrate the Purim. And this year we got a very special celebrity because we are just living the story of the our enemies as destroyed.
Israeli politicians often held up Khamenei as the modern-day version of Haman. In fact, in his speech announcing the start of the war, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made the comparison. He and other Israeli leaders have often invoked the story of Purim as an argument to go after their enemies before their enemies come for them. For The World, I'm Aaron Schachter.
Okay, enough of the news humans are making. Let's turn our focus to some of the other creatures on this planet.
Scientists have identified a whale highway they did not know about before, as well as a feeding site. Those are used by endangered pygmy blue whales, according to Indonesian researchers. Those researchers attached a tag to one whale and were able to follow it with a drone for the first time, seeing a previously unknown passage the species follows on its southern migration. Pygmy blue whales live in the Indian and South Pacific Oceans, and their habits have long remained a mystery.
That is some good animal news. Meanwhile, thousands of birds have been washing up off the coasts of England, France, Spain, and Portugal, mostly Atlantic puffins. The Royal Society for the Protection of Birds in the UK says recent storms and bad weather could be the cause of the die-off. Scientists think recent storms have made water currents too strong for birds to swim against, and that's kept them from finding food.
Finally, cheetahs. Eight new cheetahs have been flown from Botswana to India to join the 38 cheetahs already there as part of an ongoing effort to repopulate the species in the country. So far, the program has brought about several cub births in India, and the cheetahs are doing pretty well.
And those are a few updates for you from the wider animal kingdom.
Just ahead, European nations get caught up in the spreading conflict against Iran and assess their military strategies. You are listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Europe is not isolated from the ongoing war in Iran. Since the joint U.S.-Israeli attacks began, Iran has hit back at Western military targets across the region. One Iranian drone exploded on a British military base in Cyprus. Another reached a French naval base in Abu Dhabi. Both the U.K. and France have since pledged to defend their interests and allies in the Gulf, and that has the potential to widen the war further. The World's Jerry Haddon reports.
Hours after Iran came under attack, the so-called E3 released a hasty statement. The E3 are France, Germany, and the UK, Europe's three biggest militaries. Among other things, they said, "We didn't do this." There was no condemnation of what Israel publicly calls its preemptive strike on Iran, what U.S. President Donald Trump has referred to as regime change. But both are illegal actions under international law. Nevertheless, Europe's chosen to fall in line with the U.S.
Les attaques de missiles, de drones lancés en réponse par l'Iran.
In France, President Emmanuel Macron spoke at an emergency cabinet meeting. He called Iran's missile and drone attacks across the region disproportionate and indiscriminate. Though not all appear indiscriminate, one Iranian drone struck a French naval base in the port of Abu Dhabi, causing a fire but no injuries. Macron has since ordered France's one aircraft carrier to the eastern Mediterranean.
Les dégâts ne sont que matériels et limités, il n'y a aucun blessé à déplorer.
There was only material damage in the drone attack, Macron said, but the attack has only reinforced our commitment to stand by those nations with which we have defense treaties. In this case, the United Arab Emirates. The Americans and Israelis have kept up the massive bombardment of Iranian military targets, and Iran continues to launch more drones. One hit a British Air Force base on Cyprus. Like Francis Macron, UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer used the incident to edge the UK closer to direct involvement.
The only way to stop the threat is to destroy the missiles at source, in their storage depots, or the launchers. The United States has requested permission to use British bases for that specific and limited defensive purpose. We have taken the decision to accept this request.
Starmer was addressing the nation on television Sunday. Yesterday, he took his arguments to the House of Commons.
To be clear, the use of British bases is limited to the agreed defensive purposes. We are not joining the US and Israeli offensive strikes. The basis for our decision is the collective self-defense of long-standing friends and allies,
and protecting British lives.
Also to that end, Starmer reiterated that the UK would play its own active role in defense, promising to stop at nothing to protect British soldiers, citizens, and allies in the Gulf region.
I've been speaking to our Gulf partners over the weekend. They're outraged by Iran's acts, particularly as they played no part in any strikes. And they've asked us to do more to defend them. Moreover, it is my duty to protect British lives.
Critics of deeper European involvement say the more countries that join the fight, the higher the chances of the war spreading further. But Richard Worley, the international editor for Swiss newspaper Blick, says he thinks this conflict will remain regional.
I don't see Europe as taking part of what could be a world conflict. I more see some European countries, the most powerful of them, respecting their defense commitment toward these Arab country allies.
In other words, this conflict can't become truly global, he says, as long as one side is fighting alone.
And that is why we have, all of us, difficulty to understand the strategy of Iran, because they are waging a strategy of total war against the countries in the Gulf, while nobody, no entity comes to their rescue.
Not their traditional backers, Russia and China, he says, who are reluctant to be drawn into this conflict, and not Iran's weakened proxy militias, who once upon a time could be called upon to sow terror to Iran's advantage.
So they are the back on the wall. They have decided to fight and to continue to have this threat of terror in the region. But how can you terrorize the region if you are the only one?
This war is just days old. President Trump has said he thinks the bombing campaign could last several weeks. Whether it remains regional is impossible to know. Eli Garanmaya with the European Council on Foreign Relations said on the Council's podcast Monday that this doesn't have to become a much larger conflict for European nations to be hurt. Unlike the United States, she said, Europe is within rocket range of the conflict.
And if, as a European, your key goals are sort of stability in the region to ensure global commodity prices stay afloat, that you don't have a country that is far bigger in population and size than any other country where we've had a refugee influx from, for example, Libya, Iraq, Syria, that you want to try and make sure that there isn't a failed state.
The worry over attacks, oil prices, economic instability, and a potential mass exodus of refugees towards the European Union. All of that has the EU calling for a ceasefire and a return to negotiations over Iran's nuclear program, or what's left of it. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon.
Finally today, it's one of the buzziest and most awarded films of the past year. The Secret Agent, a Brazilian movie, heads into the Oscars in just under 2 weeks with 4 nominations.
Essa é a pessoa.
Eu quero buraco na boca.
The dialogue there, this is the person, I want a hole blown through his mouth.
Oh, I'm stressed out just listening to it. The 3-hour drama has already bagged 76 prizes, including for Best Actor and Director, from the Golden Globes to Cannes and beyond.
One thing that has not gotten as many accolades but also stands out is the film's music. Songs that nod to the revolutionary sounds that captivated Brazil in its turbulent period of dictatorship in the 1970s, like this psychedelic composition with its hypnotic military parade cadence. The music actually comes from a film from that time by the Italian maestro Ennio Morricone, whose work was loved in Brazil. It's titled Guerra e Pace, Pollo e Brace, or War and Peace, Chicken and Ribs. It's a surreal summary of the zeitgeist then, as well as now.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and check out more of our reporting on YouTube. We are at The World News GBH. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Join us right back here tomorrow.
is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Pigott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.